even the most complicated meal begins with basics. The vegetable stock you made with leftovers, that perfectly runny egg, or the delicious dessert that you didn't spend all day preparing. These are the small victories in the kitchen, the ones that taste incredible and still leave us time for other things, like each other. We're going to focus on the simple side of cooking today. Low stakes, high payoff recipes laid out in a new cookbook called, yep, Small Victories. Julia Tertian is the author, weaving her own stories of success and trial by error into the recipes themselves. She's co-authored cookbooks with Mario Batali, Gwyneth Paltrow, among others, and she joins us now from her home in New York. Julia Tertian, welcome to The Exchange.
Thanks so much for having me, Emily. I'm so happy to talk about small victories with you.
Yeah, me too. Especially many people, myself included, were planning a big meal this week. So I really took heart looking at this recipe book of sort of simple ways, almost like kitchen hacks. The small victories, they aren't the dishes themselves, but rather like the little ways that when you prepare the dishes, you make them easier and more delicious or simpler. How did you get this idea?
I think you have done such a great job describing it. And for me, it's how I learned to cook and how I taught myself to cook. And it was by paying attention to all these small victories, which are these sort of tips, techniques, ideas that just sort of help you realize, the building blocks of home cooking. And I think by accumulating a lot of them and stopping to pause and celebrate them, it's just the best way to become a really confident home cook. And to me, they're kind of like the puzzle pieces in the kitchen. And once you sort of, I think of them as kind of like the corners, the edges. And mm-hmm. once you sort of have that framework, you can kind of fill in the rest and mix and match. And, it's definitely what I attempted to do in the book by introducing all the recipes with small victories, but then also following each recipe with, I call them spin-offs, and they're sort of just variations. So the idea is once you know the tip or technique, you can make one thing, but you can also make so many other things.
And so many things to dig into in this book. We've got a delicious 40 minutes ahead of us. Before we get there, though, I want to talk a little bit more about your background. How did it all begin with celery for you?
It's sort of the first line of the book that it began with celery, which is a little bit vague, but that for me means going back to the kitchen I grew up in, which was the small kitchen in the apartment in New York City where I grew up. And basically asking my parents over and over to buy bunches of celery so I could practice chopping. And then once I was able to get sort of an even dice and keep the celery, on the board and not flying around, I moved on to sauteing it in a pan. I tried to flip it in the air like I had seen, chefs do on television. And these moments of figuring things out, of, getting that dice perfected, of getting that saute, to be effective, those were those sort of small victories. So to me, when I think back to learning how to become a really calm and confident home cook, it does indeed start with celery.
Right. And I don't know that you could pick a less glamorous vegetable to showcase there.
It was affordable was a big thing.
Right. And I mean, for me, I also have been known to eat quite a bit of celery, carrots, these affordable vegetables that they're not known for their sex appeal, but they are known for appealing to people maybe who don't see themselves as master chefs or even people who have out and out phobias of cooking. I know I have family members like that. They insist that they can't cook. I wonder how they stay alive. We all come together for Thanksgiving. Where can someone like that even begin? Someone, who maybe has already told themselves for years and years that all they can do is this, this, and this, and that's, they only know how to make two things. That's it. That's all I know.
Yeah, exactly. So a lot of the sort of premise of Small Victories comes from having that very similar conversation with lots of my own friends and family. And I would say to them, you actually don't know how to make two things. You can make 200 things. You just don't know it yet. And this idea of the skills that are used in a single recipe can be applied in so many different recipes. So to that person, the first question I would ask her, what are those two things and do you enjoy them? Because that's sort of the best place to start, is to make the things that you really like. So if you're someone who loves, ordering roast chicken in a restaurant, that's something you can easily do at home. And I think that's a great place to start. So I think starting from the dishes that you really enjoy is the best way, because then it means you're going to be making things you enjoy, which leads to making more things you enjoy. So I would start there.
Right. And you start, appropriately enough, in your book, Small Victories, with breakfast, and talk about a foundational meal for foundational recipes with eggs. You know, most people would say, okay, I can cook an egg and that's it. How is there a small victory to be had just in frying up an egg?
Sure. Yeah, that's actually one of my favorite recipes in the book, and it's one of the simplest, and it's a fried egg that's served on, you basically smear some yogurt that's mixed with lemon on your plate and then put a fried egg on top. So as you eat it, it sort of almost makes this kind of like delicious sauce. And
Hollandaise-y sort of.
Yeah, exactly. Hollandaise. Like so much easier, uh-huh. Like so much easier and definitely a little bit better for you. So to fry that egg, which is such a fundamental thing in cooking, my tip for that, which helps just sort of cook the egg evenly, even on top, and helps you avoid getting an undercooked egg white, which I'll eat just about anything, but that's one thing I really just don't like. And so my tip is, when you're frying the egg, to put a few drops of water in the skillet that you're cooking the egg in, and not directly on the egg, just sort of next to it in the pan.
Just a few drops.
Exactly. And I'm like, I realize I'm talking with my hands right now, but no one can see. So I'm showing what a few drops looks like.
Are you, and then you're flicking it with your fingers?
Exactly.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And then you put a lid on the skillet. And basically what that little bit of water does, just those few drops, is just creates a little bit of steam. And the lid will kind of trap the steam in the skillet. And what that's going to do is sort of cook the egg on top as well as from underneath with the heat of the pan. And what that ensures is you almost make like this little oven, and it's cooking the top of the egg so the egg white gets fully cooked. But it's such a gentle heat because it's just steam, so it will, you know, allow you to keep that runny yolk if that's what you like, which is definitely what I like. And it just turns out just perfect eggs, and it's like the simplest little thing, but it makes a big difference. So that's sort of the crux of Small Victories, is finding those little tricks that are really easy, that don't require a lot of effort, but just help you turn out things that are reliably good.
Yeah, and the springboard, I think, from there is, in your family anyway, and certainly in my house, you can make a meal out of anything by adding an egg on top of it. So
oh,
I'm like,
yeah.
Oh, I have sort of a lackluster salad. Let's just throw a poached egg on there. Oh, my gosh, this is fancy. What are some of your favorite things to sort of jazz up with an egg?
Oh, my God. Like, it'd be quicker to tell you the things that I don't put an egg on. I do believe that. I think an egg just sort of makes a meal out of anything. One of my favorite things to put it on, it's another recipe in the book, is kimchi fried rice, which is basically just leftover rice that you put chopped kimchi in and warm it up. And that with a fried egg on top is, to me, like one of the best things in the world. And the egg, you know, makes it more filling, but it also just, that runny yolk kind of creates this rich sauce. It's one of my favorite things.
And if you can't tell, I'm an egg fan. Before we leave eggs entirely, what is the best way to hard boil an egg? This is a snack that has long sustained journalists like me and other kitchen challenge people for our snacks. How do you make it so that it's just right and not too green on the inside or not too runny? You know, what's the best way?
Sure. Well, I've tried a whole bunch of different ways, and the way that I just have come back to, which informed the recipe in the book, is to basically put however many eggs you're making in a pot and cover them quite substantially with some water, so they've got a good like inch of water on top. Bring it to a boil, put a cover on that pot, and then turn off the heat. So actually, a hard-boiled egg isn't actually hard-boiled. It's just that water is brought to a boil, and then it's turned off. And those eggs just sit in that hot water and cook a little bit more gently. And I leave it for about 10 minutes and then cool them off with some cool water. And they turn out perfectly each time. And the other thing I would add to that is, you know, that helps, you know, create this perfectly cooked egg. But I think the hardest part is sometimes peeling them, and sometimes the shell can be quite stubborn. So I highly recommend using older eggs, and I find that they're so much easier to peel. So it's, you know, eggs that have been in your fridge for a week or two are going to be a lot easier to peel than fresh eggs. And for the most part, you hear lots of cookbook authors and chefs talk about using fresh ingredients everywhere, and this is the one case where it actually benefits you to use something that's a little bit older.
We're putting our old eggs before the chicken here with a recipe author, Julia Thurschen. She's with us talking about her new book, Small Victories, Recipes, Advice, and Hundreds of Ideas ideas for home cooking triumphs, you can join the discussion here on The Exchange between me and Julia. It's 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. So many beautiful recipes and beautifully photographed recipes in this book, Julia. In the course of this interview, I'm really focusing more on sort of these tricks with the ingredients rather than, you know, the recipes themselves. What's the small victory like chilaquiles with roasted tomato salsa? You know, for you, it's all about figuring out how to turn something old into something new. That's a real theme in this book, taking your leftovers or the stuff that you would normally just chuck out or compost and giving it new life. Is that something that's really important to you in your kitchen?
Absolutely. And I think it really is all about home cooking because for me, you know, I live in a small town kind of in the middle of nowhere. So I cook at home every day and we eat pretty much all of our meals at home. And I think one of the best things about home cooking is the way you can kind of reuse, you know, what you made yesterday into something new for today. And it's a sort of ever-evolving kind of refrigerator that just lends itself to, you know, new meals. And I feel like that's one of the things I love about it is it allows you to be so creative and to keep turning things that you think might not have much life in them into fully new things. So the chilaquiles is such a great example because, you know, you're taking older tortillas that might, you know, seem a little stale or not so great, and then you just turn them into this amazing thing that's, I think, even better than like, you know, what they were originally.
With eggs on top to stick
exactly.
with our theme. Yeah. Another one, you know, you mentioned there's a soup in there that's uses the rinds of the Parmesan cheese, recipes that use the juice left over in a jar of preserved lemons. I know I always have a lot of olive juice hanging around because I'm an olive fiend. I think one of the more staple things that we make out of leftovers is our stock, our vegetable stock or our chicken stock. What makes the best kind of stock for you?
Sure. Yeah, I feel like all of those things are such great examples of sort of finding life in older ingredients and just really not wasting anything and being kind of both economical and creative, which I think is just a great mix in a home kitchen. And stock is such a great example. And I think what makes a great stock is really patience and letting it cook for a really long time. And it can contain just about anything. It can contain vegetable scraps. It can contain, you know, bones from a roasted chicken. It can contain beef bones, a mix of all those things. And you can make great stock out of just about anything. And I think the thing that really serves you well is just letting it cook nice and slow for a really long time. And you basically can't overcook stock.
Uh-huh. And, you know, you have this great tip in here to actually take your stock and bag it up and freeze it so you have these sort of soup on the go or soup whenever you want it ready to go. How did you pick up that idea?
So that started when I was in college. I developed this sort of funny form of procrastination, which is that I would make soup all the time, like all the time.
In lieu of doing other things.
Exactly. Uh-huh. So I've always found the kitchen a really productive place to put off doing something else. And so I would make these big batches of soup, and then I've never liked eating the same thing every single day, so I would freeze the soup in like individual portions in, you know, resealable plastic bags, and then I would lay them flat in the freezer. And then once they were frozen, I would line them up. So it was almost like the filing cabinet in the freezer.
Uh-huh.
And I would, you know, then a night if I, you know, had a lot of homework or whatever, I could just heat up one of those. I would give them to friends when they stopped by. So I always had all this soup in the freezer. And these days I prefer to just freeze stock like that. So then I can use the stock to make soup with whatever leftovers I have on hand. So, you know, say it's a little bit of leftover roast chicken, maybe some cooked rice and a couple of vegetables. You know, I can have this great bowl of chicken and rice soup so easily with a lot of flavor from that stock. So I think having just the stock as opposed to the soup gives you a little bit more flexibility. So it's definitely something I love to do.
It can become anything. Stocking up on your stock, quite literally in your freezer there. I love the soup chapter of this book, Small Victories. And so many of the recipes, they do contain a personal story about where you picked up the idea or who taught it to you. I want to talk a little bit about Aunt Renee's chicken soup. You write in there that when she died, you did publish an obituary, and all it said is, "I will take care of the soup." Can you tell us, how are you caring for Aunt Renee's chicken soup recipe?
Sure. Yeah, this one always makes me cry, so I'll try not to. But it's the cover of the book, the bowl of her soup. And she was amazing, and she was, among many things, a really amazing home cook. And she would always cook, you know, even if two people were stopping by, she would cook for 20. She was one of those kinds of cooks. And she just always had food, like tons and tons of it. And the thing that I remember the most is her chicken soup, and it was just a really great classic Jewish chicken soup. And to me, the thing that I've always been so drawn to in cookbooks is not just the food, but the stories behind the food. So in my own cookbook, you know, I wanted to include all the tips and the techniques, small victories, but I also wanted to give good context about why these recipes mean so much to me. And I think the chicken soup is the best example, because not only is it my favorite food and I could eat it every single day, it's just so tied to my family and my history, and I feel like every time I make it and then eat it, I just feel so connected to everything and everyone that, you know, I came from. And I think food has this amazing power to do that, and there's such an emotional, you know, sort of aspect to cooking that, you know, really is just so transformative, and I think it can really mean so much in so many different ways. And for me, the chicken soup is just the best example of that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you think Aunt Renee's proud of how you're carrying on the tradition there?
And... Oh, I sure hope so, definitely. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I want to move on from soup, because there's so much to cover in this book. It's called Small Victories. We've got breakfast, soups, vegetables, grains, beans, meat, poultry, shellfish, desserts, other odds and ends, and even a humble can of chickpeas gets its own play in this book by Julia Tertian. You can join our discussion here on The Exchange. I'm Emily Curitan, and if preparing even a simple meal sends you into a cold sweat, or maybe you're a master and you have some tips for us, either way, we want to hear from you. If you're in the middle, that's great too. Just give us a call, 800-838-3760, or send us an email, jx@jeffnet.org. We have a comment here from Boyd in Wolf Creek. Boyd said that fresh yellow organic ginger is good in everything. Veggies, fruit, warming teas, it's the key to winter cuisine. What do you say about that, Julia? You use a lot of ginger?
Oh, I love ginger. I actually just last night cooked with a ton of it. I put it in lots of things, and actually that chicken soup we were just talking about with it, with a load of fresh ginger in it, it becomes a whole different thing, and it's delicious. So, yeah, I agree with him.
I noticed in the one of the sections of your book about drinks and just things that you like to keep on hand in your kitchen, you mention a cold elixir beverage that incorporates some ginger. Is that part of, I was a little bit surprised to see a cold elixir in a cookbook, but do you swear by that? Does that go well with Aunt Renee's chicken soup?
Yeah, I definitely think, you know, food can be sort of medicine in a way, and absolutely chicken soup is one of those. And the recipe you're talking about, the cold elixir, is,
yeah,
you know, by no means a cure for the common cold. I think if that existed, we would all just go get that, whatever it is. But it definitely has helped me a lot when I have colds. And it's just a really nice hot drink that includes all sorts of things that are really good for you and help help you feel better and help you, you know, clear your sinuses and stuff. There's a little cayenne. You can add cinnamon, ginger, apple cider vinegar, which is really good for you. So, yeah, it might not be a cure, but it definitely is an aid.
Right, like so much of food, right?
Absolutely. And I think food can be, you know, we were just talking about it, it can be so many things and so emotional, and it can also be so healing. So I think there's a lot you can do in the kitchen to help you take care of you know, just your body. And it's amazing, certain things you can eat and drink that just help you feel so much better.
Well, and I was surprised to see, going back to, you know, thinking about your family history and things that make us feel better because maybe they remind us of someone or of a place that we used to be. You mentioned in the book that your grandparents owned a bakery. I think it was your grandfather loved lox. And I was actually very surprised to see cured fish come up right away in the book, because to me that's a very intimidating thing to produce. Could you talk to me a little bit more about that, about making lox and the relationship it has with your past and how you learned to care about these recipes so much?
Sure, yeah. So that recipe is, it's one of those things that I think seems quite intimidating, but it's actually pretty simple to make. And I think the only thing it requires that we don't all have on hand is just a lot of time because you have to let it sit for a bit. But it's just a combination of sugar and salt that you pack on, you know, a good quality piece of fish and let it do its thing. And I think it's a fun recipe to make, and I think it's cool to sort of understand that these things that seem sort of out of reach for home cooks are actually quite doable. So I really liked putting that recipe up front. And my family, on my mom's side, I come from a long line of bread bakers. And on my dad's side, my great-grandfather had a flour mill. And between those two things, I have a deep love of really good bread and bagels and that kind of thing. And coming from a Jewish family in New York, a bagel or, you know, a good piece of pumpernickel toast, that kind of thing, with some kind of salty fish of any sort, so whether it be lox or whitefish salad, mm-hmm. is just something that is such a comfort food to me and is definitely something I've inherited from both sides of my family.
Well, it's a comfort to me to even be talking about so much good food here with Julia Tershin. Her new book is called Small Victories, and it's a collection of hundreds of ideas for home cooking using pretty much what you would have on hand in the kitchen. Not getting too fancy, but taking a lot of care with the ingredients and keeping it simple. These little kitchen hacks, we have many more of them to talk about. And I want to dig into ideas for Thanksgiving dinner, which of course is right around the corner. So stick with us on The Exchange. We'll be taking your questions and comments after a short break. Phone number and email address will be provided then. Thanks for listening. Back on the Jefferson Exchange, I'm Emily Cureton, and if you're just joining us, our guest is Julia Tershin, a writer and recipe developer. We're talking home cooking this hour, ways to keep it simple and cook with what you have. These recipes are designed to make even the humblest stuff shine. Join us with your questions, comments, tales from the kitchen. We want to hear them. 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. So, Julia, you were just talking about your family's history with bread and baking and kind of what a central role this plays in your life. I must admit, I am one of those people. I'm afraid of yeast, and I have turned more than one sourdough starter into a fridge mutant before just chucking the whole thing out and saying never again. What can I do to get past that and to actually be able to make homemade bread?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I definitely understand that. And I used to be someone who felt the same way when I, you know, saw yeast in a recipe in a cookbook. I would just turn the page. I thought, no way. Like, you know, that sounds cool, but not for me. That's above my head. And then a couple things helped me kind of come around to it. And one was sort of, one that was really helpful was I worked on a bread baking book. So I got to learn a lot and learn from people who knew way more than I did. So that was great. And then sort of taking those lessons and really kind of demystifying this thing that seems so intimidating and approaching yeast as if it's any other leavening agent. So I think the way that many of us, wouldn't blink an eye to use something like baking powder or baking soda in a recipe, say you're making like a banana bread or something, mm-hmm. you know, to me at least that seems quite doable. Like, yeah, that's no problem. I'll add a spoonful of that. It's going to do its thing. I trust it. And approaching yeast in the same way. And, you know, it's a little bit more nuanced and you have to get it started, you know, mix it with water, that kind of thing. But I think just treating it like any other tool in the kitchen and thinking about it just as you would think about something like baking powder. So sort of taking the intimidation out of it and just realizing that it's a tool that's going to help you. It's going to, you know, add this levity to whatever you're making. So the recipe in the book that that uses it are these delicious raspberry jam buns. Mm-hmm. And it's basically like a cinnamon roll. Like, it's a yeasted dough, but instead of being filled with cinnamon and sugar, I fill them with raspberry jam, and then you roll them up, and, you know, you get this jam that's spiraled in the dough. And they're beautiful, but they're also just so delicious. But the thing that I love most about that recipe are not only the raspberry jam buns, which I really love, but that dough, it becomes this blank canvas for anything. So you can turn them into cinnamon rolls by, you know, filling them with cinnamon and sugar, but you can also fill them with melted butter and garlic and parsley and have almost like garlic knot rolls. You can turn it into a loaf of yeasted bread. You know, it's this dough that can be anything. So I think realizing that, you know, not being afraid of something like yeast opens the door to so many wonderful homemade, home-baked goods is definitely something worth considering.
And I'm looking at the pictures now of these raspberry jam buns with creme fraiche frosting, and it's pretty hard to stay here in front of the microphone, not just like run home and start cooking them, or maybe cheat and go somewhere with a professional chef on hand. You mentioned, you know, yeast being a tool of the kitchen and a sort of a vehicle to get you where you want to go with so many different recipes, that being foundational to this book, where if you kind of learn one trick, one thing, you can use your creativity and your ingenuity to apply it to other things. I would like to step back for a second, and I meant to ask you about some of the inedible tools of the kitchen. You start out the book saying we only need three knives, a big sharp one, a serrated one, and a little one for paring vegetables. What are some of the other non-edibles that are essential in your kitchen?
Sure. Yeah, I think it's definitely something that's really important to think about, all the tools that help you make all these delicious things. And to me, I approach equipment in the kitchen the same way I approach cooking, which is basically less is more. And a few, you know, really sturdy things are going to serve you well, and you don't need that many gadgets. So I think those three knives that you mentioned are essential and are the only knives you need. They do everything. I think really heavy-duty, like stainless steel sheet pans are great. I use them all the time for, you know, whether it's making cookies or roasting vegetables, or I'll roast a chicken on a sheet pan. Use them to bring things out to my grill and back. I use them for everything. And lightweight stainless steel mixing bowls I love, and I feel like you can't really have too many of those. And I love them because I'm not afraid of breaking them. Like, I think those nesting glass bowls are really beautiful, and people like those, but I'm always scared I'm going to drop them. And mm-hmm. I always want the one that's like in the middle, and then you have to take a bunch out and put, you know, that kind of thing. So I think tools that are sturdy and, you know, you're not afraid to really use and get in there. So those are some of my favorite things. A nice big wooden cutting board is great, and I think it's always better to have one that's, you know, a little bit too big for the job than the other way around, because,
right,
you know, you're always trying to keep a ton of stuff on a small space, which is hard. So, and I think one of my favorite places to buy all these things are restaurant supply stores. They tend to be a lot more affordable and kind of only have the things that are really, you know, sturdy.
Oh, interesting. But do you have to buy in bulk if you go to, can you go into a restaurant supply store and buy one cutting board, please?
Yeah, many of them. Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, good to know.
And they're fun. They're fun to go to.
Yeah.
Because you can see things like giant, you know, stock pots that you could probably fit in. So maybe you're not going to buy those.
Ooh, an idea for your least favorite relative this Thanksgiving. Weird Uncle Soup is not actually in the book. But speaking of your sort of this ethics of simple that you apply to your tools, to these recipes, how does it figure into your choice of spices?
Sure. Yeah. I think, same thing goes, that I think, starting with just a couple ones that you really enjoy and use frequently are great. I also really like buying, small amounts of spices because they don't have, the longest shelf life. I mean, they last for a good amount of time, but they don't last for years and years. And, you know, my grandmother, who I adore, and no offense to my grandma, but her spice shelf in her house, I mean, she's moved them from house to house to house, and it's, you know, it's the same containers, and I think at this point they're probably just, you know, flavorless kind of dust. So I think, especially if you're trying a new spice and you're not sure if you like it, if you have the opportunity to buy a small amount, so sometimes certain, like, health food stores and stuff will have them in like a bulk section, so you can fill like a small jar or small bag. So that's good, because otherwise I think you end up with a lot of a lot of things that you use once and never again. And then if you learn that you really love something, you know, of course, buy the bigger jar.
And, all right, so zooming out big time here, we haven't gotten to talking about meat, which is a big part of, at least for me, the centerpiece of this week. You advise us to cook meat and poultry when it's at room temperature. Why is that?
Yeah, I think definitely, like, let's take a roast chicken, for example. If you take a chicken straight out of the fridge and put it straight into a hot oven, it's basically going to take a long time for the temperature of the chicken to sort of match the temperature of the oven. And I think so one reason to bring things to room temperature first is just to save you cooking time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's definitely really helpful. But I also think that you get a much better result because basically you're not putting something ice cold into something that's, you know, blazing hot. And I think about, like, you know, if you, you know, jump into an ice cold swimming pool or something, you're going to, you know, be shocked and sort of tense up, and meat and poultry kind of do the same thing. So I think shocking things as little as possible is definitely just a good thing to do in general and keep in mind.
And do you have sort of an overarching philosophy when you're dealing with a big piece of flesh, whether it's ham or a bird or a roast pork loin? Just how I think I get intimidated here too when it's like, oh, I don't have, do you need a meat thermometer? I guess is a good place to start.
Sure. Yeah. I think two things. One is, like, when it comes to, I know a lot of people are probably planning to make a big turkey this
uh-huh.
week. And I, this might sound silly, but to me, roasting a turkey is no different than roasting, like, a really big chicken. So think about something you would do on a smaller scale. And just allow for a little extra time. And, you know, I think it doesn't have to be any more intimidating than that. And in terms of a meat thermometer, you know, I know I just mentioned I'm not that into gadgets, but I actually think a digital meat thermometer is really handy because it takes a lot of guesswork out. And you can just know, you know, what temperature something is, and you don't have to guess, and you don't have to jiggle this or cut into that and that kind of thing, or poke something.
Mm-hmm.
And
do a little rain dance. And then,
yeah, and I think it gives you really concrete, direct information, which is really helpful. So I use a meat thermometer all the time, and I think the more you cook meat and poultry and those kinds of things, you know, the more comfortable you get doing it. You know, I'll be roasting a turkey this Thursday, and it's probably, you know, the 20th time I've done that. So I feel pretty comfortable doing it at this point. But for a lot of people, if it's your first time, like, you don't have to be, you know, an expert. You don't have to know the way it feels, you know, how that's going to indicate what it is on the inside. Just use a tool that's going to give you all that information. So I definitely advocate for a thermometer, for sure.
So what's a small victory in this, your 20th turkey?
So I am a big fan of roasting a smaller turkey. If we're going to be 12 people this year, and in my family sometimes we've been as large as 30 people, and I, if we were having a big group, instead of roasting a larger turkey, I would roast two turkeys. I think a smaller turkey is, it's going to cook faster. It's also just a lot easier to handle, and it's easier to carve. It's going to take, less time to cook. And so I like doing that. And this year I'm actually doing a small turkey and an extra turkey breast because most people in my family actually really, I think a lot of people prefer dark meat, but in my family the preference tends to be white meat. So as opposed to having this huge bird and having to, you know, dismantle it, I'd rather have one smaller bird and a little extra white meat on the side. And so that's how I'm going about it. And I'm just roasting it, like I said, as if it were a big chicken. So probably around 400 degrees. I'll take it out a couple hours before it goes in the oven so it's not too cold. Just, you know, some herbs, salt and pepper, keep it simple.
And you advise on your chicken recipe to salt and let it air dry at room temperature for 2 hours. What's the rationale there?
So that's going to give you, and I'm going to actually do the same with the turkey this year, it's going to give you really crispy skin. So basically, you're letting, the air sort of help evaporate any moisture that's on the surface of the turkey. And so when it goes in the oven, it doesn't have to waste time doing that, and it can just get straight to the work of getting really brown and crispy. So that works really well and is definitely something that I think is useful, whether you're roasting a chicken, a turkey, a large piece of meat or pork or anything like that.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Julia Tertian. She's a writer, a recipe developer, and it sounds like she's going to be cooking an amazing Thanksgiving dinner. If you want to pick her brain, now is the time. 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org to join the conversation with your own stories from the kitchen or with questions you might have about preparing Thanksgiving or any meal. We started out talking about how to hard-boil eggs. We've gotten very deftly here to roasting a turkey. And I would like to talk also about the sides that are on deck for Thanksgiving, Julia. You have a recipe in your book about sweet potatoes and somewhat surprisingly, the small victory or the secret ingredient of your Grace's sweet potatoes are actually onions. Can you talk more about that?
Sure, yeah. That's a terrific side dish that the combination I take no credit for. It's from my wife, Grace, who came up with them, which is why they're called Grace's Sweet Potatoes. And she sort of invented them one day. I was working on another book, and a recipe in that book was these slowly cooked onions that got turned into this onion jam. And
onion
it was a delicious
jam.
Recipe. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was so good. And so I was testing that recipe, and so I was cooking lots and lots of onions. So our fridge had containers of, you know, slowly cooked onions, which are great on their own. But we got a little sick of just these onions. And so Grace roasted, she diced a sweet potato or a couple, roasted them, folded them with the onions, and added some crispy, I think we had pancetta or bacon in the fridge. And it was such a good combination. So for this recipe, I started with, you know, you cook that pork product, and it can be anything, bacon, pancetta, you know, whatever you've got. And then I cook the onions in that fat and then mix them with roasted sweet potatoes. And it's such a delicious dish, and it's sort of, you know, sweet and a little salty, and you have this sort of richness from the sweet potatoes and the onions, and it's so good. It's definitely something I would recommend.
Any other sides not to be missed in small victories that would be a good complement to a Thanksgiving dinner?
Sure, yeah, there's definitely quite a few. And I'll add for those sweet potatoes, you can actually totally leave out the pork if you want them to be vegetarian. I know this year for my family, we have a few vegans and vegetarians, so I'm sort of keeping in mind those sort of things.
Will you make two versions, or are you just going to make the whole thing?
I think just one. Sort of keep it simple for, you know, for the cook.
Yeah.
Some other good sides from small victories are actually, one that's a little bit kind of unexpected but would be a nice thing to sort of complement the meal are roasted radishes. And radishes aren't something you normally see cooked, but they get delicious and sort of sweet and rich. And I did them in the book with olive dressing, because radishes and olives go so well together. So that could be kind of a really cool addition and something you don't see very often. And the other thing I'd recommend is for when people get to your home, or you can bring if you're going to someone else's home, is the roasted scallion dip, which you can eat with potato chips. And it's a delicious way to start the meal, and it goes so well with drinks.
Roasted scallion chips?
Roasted scallion dip.
Dip,
and,
okay.
Yeah, so it's basically like onion dip. And you get to use up scallions and chives and those delicious kinds of things. So that's a great way to start the meal. And for other side dishes to just go, you know, with your turkey and everything, there's a really simple creamed corn recipe that's just, you know, corn, salt, a little butter, and a little bit of cream. And you can actually make it with frozen corn. It would be delicious. So that would be a really nice addition and just so easy to make.
And so finishing off our meal here, what's your go-to dessert if you only want to use one, two, or at the most three ingredients?
For Thanksgiving or just in general?
Just in general. I'm pretty loose with my what goes on Thanksgiving.
Yeah, for Thanksgiving, I definitely say the best thing to do for dessert is delegate.
Right. Invite people.
Exactly. Just sort of one last thing. So, yeah, for dessert anytime, I really love, there's a recipe for a peach and bourbon milkshake in the book.
Oh, yeah.
I love serving milkshakes for dessert. I think people don't expect them. They're super fun, and, you know, everyone loves a milkshake. And those, you know, it's a really great combination of flavors. And, you know, they're great in the summer with fresh peaches, but it also works extremely well with frozen peaches, and it doesn't require that much work at all. So I would definitely recommend those.
Well, Julia, we just have a few seconds remaining here, and you do advise, last little Zen tip in the book, when someone invites you to dinner and they say, oh, don't bring anything, you say, please, bring something. Has this advice increased your dinner invites?
That's a good question. I guess maybe. I think I definitely... Yeah, I don't like showing up empty-handed, so.
All right. Well, our guest today has been Julia Tertian. She is the author of a new recipe collection called Small Victories. It is an amazing way to build your foundation in the kitchen. Julia, thanks for joining us on The Exchange.
Thank you so much for having me. This was so fun to talk to you about the book.